I have to say, coming to this meeting, I feel like some of my plasma physics colleagues, like Umstead and Freeman, feel like coming to a rehab meeting. My name is Todd Dittmeyer, and I don't do attisecond science, but I'm trying. In fact, Buxbaum has come here and told me that LCLS is an attisecond machine now. It's amazing. It's because it's got attisecond. That's kind of like me saying, I'm a skinny guy because parts of me are skinny. I mean, it's I appreciate you guys inviting me to come out and get away from the Texas heat for a bit. So I was kind of painting about what I should talk about since I don't do attisecond science. I was thinking, well, you guys probably didn't want to hear about laser-driven spall or blast wave and shock physics, which is measured in a gigaattisecond. So I started talking about this rubbish anyway. So I'm going to apologize. A little bit of wandering kind of talk. I want to sort of, the general theme here is talking about cluster explosions and short wavelength light. Okay, and the connection will be tenuous. But the hope was here was to sort of maybe talk about some things I don't understand and maybe seed some conversations with the theorists here. For example, the actually skinny Christoph Keisel, or Wheel Rose. So I'm going to wander on. Anyway, so to those of you who were at dinner last night, you will be happy to know that I'm not going to say a single thing about high energy density physics offices in the Department of Energy. Although I may throw in a couple of jokes about wheels. So those of you who weren't there, actually, we went to dinner last night, and Jan Michael shows up bearing the wheel of his newly purchased bicycle, and he brings it into the bar, and the waitress is shagging to find out that not only did she have to find 7 seats for us at the bar, but she had to find a spot for the wheel as well. So, let's see, is there any of my friends I haven't made fun of yet? Where's Moreau? Getting serious now. Here's folks who actually do the work, have close collaborations with other folks in the department. I think I'm going to talk about some data that Mike Downer, my colleague in the department, and I have been working on in function. I've been working on that. So since I'm a laser jock masquerading as a plasma physicist, of course, if there's some laser folks in here, I'd probably say it's the other way around, but since I'm a laser jock masquerading as a plasma physicist, you know, I don't know anybody in this fancy quantum mechanics stuff, right? I'm a very classical kind of guy. So it's actually, I love his viewgraph. He actually talked about attisecond plasma physics, and I thought I was going to be the first clown to put that up here, but I wasn't. I don't think I'm actually a clown by saying this. So this is saying the obvious thing here, actually. But even in a purely classical sense, if you consider a solid density plasma, you know, the collective response of this group of electrons is just sort of roughly 1 over the plasma frequency, which is sort of the order of a couple hundred attiseconds of solid density. So that's sort of an obvious thing, but I sort of don't really think of it in those terms. But in fact, a lot of the things that we deal with infrared light pulses interacting, and we talk about these nanoclusters, is we sort of treat the electron response as infinitely fast. But of course, for this crew, it's not infinitely fast. And so sort of maybe at the end, I'll conjecture a little bit on how this response time may be interesting or not. Anyway, but anyway, as a final note, I would point out, just for my level of sophistication, as a plasma physicist, I don't even think of particles. I just treat this stuff as a fluid most of the time. But even in that classical treatment, I do stuff that still happens quickly. Okay, so one of the motivations, I think, for kind of talking about these clusters exploding and how they interact, in particular with short wavelength light, is something that Phil introduced, which is what happens in the LCLS pulse when one tries to image a large biomolecule. Okay, so these things have hundreds or even thousands of atoms, so they actually look like not so small clusters. Okay, and as Phil showed you a movie, if you calculate the ionization and calculate the Coulomb explosion, these things come apart pretty bloody quickly. And he sort of alluded to the fact that LCLS was not going to be fast enough to take a picture of one of these things. Okay, and this is, here's just to take Phil's discussion a step further. This is a figure out of the LCLS, the first experiments. This is a beautiful calculation that Yanis Hadji did a few years ago. And he calculated, this R factor here as a function of the LCLS pulse width, and here's as a function of the LCLS photon fluence. And basically, this R factor kind of says how good the image is, okay? And bigger R is bad, okay? He wants R to be something like 15%. And essentially, to get to the fluences you'd really like to get really high resolution images, or at least they calculate that this cluster, this biomolecule, will fly apart in 10 femtoseconds, okay? So that's where this 10 femtosecond number comes. So now the question is this really correct, okay? And so, you know, I think it's actually quite a fascinating question. You know, this is a very nice calculation, but this calculation essentially assumed was that any ionization was accompanied by rapid exit of the electron, okay? And sort of in cluster parlance, this is complete vertical ionization, okay? And so essentially these things exploded by Coulomb forces. Well, so we know from laser interactions with clusters that that's not really what happens. And so I kind of want to just conjecture a little bit about this, talk a little bit about what we know in terms of short pulse infrared light interactions with clusters, and then kind of maybe just conjecture about where this would go when short wavelengths are the illuminating pulse. I'd hoped to actually have some data on this. We just fell a little bit short, so instead I'm just going to show you the experiment that we're doing, and the data will have to wait till next year or next summer report. But anyway, you know, sort of the general differences here can be sort of broadly described. You know, in an infrared field at reasonable intensities, if you have a cluster, okay, we'll talk about how this goes from a Coulomb explosion to a nanoplasma. But anyway, the electron dynamics are driven by the field, okay? The strongest force is the laser field, and that drives oscillation of the electrons, leads to stochastic heating, it pulls electrons off on our fast time scale. Of course, at high intensities in an XFEL or any short wavelength pulse, the intensities are high, but the quantum of energies are not, okay? So the LCLS at intensities up to 10 to the 20 has only quantum of energies of UEV, okay? And so the electron oscillations, the amplitudes are much smaller, and so we're going to expect that there's going to be some quite substantial qualitative difference. And so it's kind of interesting to think about this. So one of the things we know that goes on in these clusters in infrared fields is that the electrons get heated by stochastic heating, and this is akin to Brunel absorption, okay? So this idea of resonance absorption in a very sharp plasma gradient, the laser field can pull electron off, slam it back into the plasma that shields the field, and the electron picks up some energy. Same thing happens in a cluster. In fact, it can happen multiple times in multiple paths. Well, this is not going to happen in a short wavelength, okay? The way that the electrons get heated should be quite different, okay? The photoionized electrons, of course, will be quite energetic and melty, but there'll be OJ electrons that come out, and they won't be quite as energetic and very well may hang around. So, you know, we even see this nanoplasma formation even in small infrared interactions with clusters, right? Here's just a simple, just to illustrate the point, here's a little argon cluster, electrons being pulled off by the field, but there's a little bit of space charge forces retain some of the electrons, and this forms just nanoplasma. And as the cluster size gets bigger, this becomes a more important effect, okay? And in fact, if you look at the ionization, even this simple little calculation, as you increase the size, the charge state you acquire in the atoms of the cluster, in this case argon, is quite a bit higher than if you just consider standard ionization mechanisms like thermal ionization. And this is because of that nanoplasma and collisional effects, okay? So all right, so this is sort of what we, or at least this is my view of the world when it comes to clusters, my simplistic experimentalist view, okay? You can sort of think about the expansion of these things in two limits, okay? The first is sort of the obvious and easier way to think about this is if you strip off all the electrons very rapidly, you're left with just a positively charged sphere. The outer ions pick up the most energy and this thing will explode, and so you know, the ion energy distribution will look something like that, okay? The other limit, of course, is if the space charge forces are strong enough, and you have high Z atoms, let's say, laser field's not that strong, the quantum of energy is not that strong, you'll basically develop this little nanoplasma, which will expand by hydrodynamic forces, right? And basically now what happens is electrons form a little ambiguous sheath, and the hottest electrons travel up fastest, and they pull the ions along with them, and you get an ion distribution, which looks quite different. The time scales for the expansion of this and this are quite different. Okay, here this depends upon the electron energies. Here, the electron energies have nothing to do with the expansion. Okay, so that's the sort of two simple limits. Okay, I'll talk a little bit about what happens in the middle in a second, show you some of the consequences. But let's talk about Coulomb explosions here for a second. Okay, you know, what are the conditions you need to acquire to drive this Coulomb explosion? And this, an experimentalist, I love these clusters because they're spherical and I can apply a simple little formula to figure things out. What I probably need to do is have a pulse which has a quantum mode of energy which is comparable or larger than the surface potential of this cluster. I need to ramp up to that on a time scale faster than it expands. Okay? So of course the quantum mode of energy, as I mentioned, these short wavelength pulses is actually quite small. Alright, even though the rise time is fast. Now, it turns out the expansion time in this case is something very simple. It's independent of the size of the cluster. It turns out it's just a roughly inverse ion plasma frequency. Okay? So if you're going to drive an efficient Coulomb explosion, and this is something we try to do in our fusion experiments, we need to rise the pulse up faster than this thing wants to expand. But anyway, you can see in the case of a light cluster, it expands pretty bloody quickly. Okay, you only have a few tens of femtoseconds. Things hanging around. Okay, so we understand, you know, this Coulomb explosion was well understood. Lots of people study this. You know, we know, for example, if we hit hydrogen and deuterium clusters at high intensity, we rip up all the electrons and the ion distribution we see. This is an ion time of flight signal from, we just whack the heck out of a gas jet of deuterium clusters and look at the time of flight. And basically convolve this Coulomb explosion formula with what we expect the cluster size distribution to be, and lo and behold, the calculation looks like it's right on top of the data. Okay, so we understand Coulomb explosion. Pretty simple. So what happens in the other one? It's a little bit more complicated and a little more interesting, really. So of course, as we all know, there's going to be some affected plasma frequency of this little nanoplasma, right? And you just do a little freshman physics calculation, and you find that the resonance frequency of this bulk electron oscillation is just the normal plasma frequency modified by the square root of 3. Okay, so this this sets the characteristic time for electrons to respond in perturbation to laser or XFEL pulse or what have you. Okay, but it also sets up a giant dipole oscillation, which if it's in resonance with the driving field can make this thing very absorptive. Okay, and we see that in experiments. I guess for the sake of a couple numbers, of course, you know, this resonance gives rise to some heating. If you put in a Drude model for the dielectric function, you find again that this resonance occurs at 3 times critical density. It's essentially what I've already said. For our infrared pulses, which is where we have lots of data, this happens at pretty low density, okay, about 1% of solid density. All right, at 100 nanometers, now it's at about solid density. Okay, so that means the XFEL pulse will have a frequency that's well above the resonance frequency of any reasonably ionized cluster. Anyway, so you can kind of get a sense of the time scale for all this happening by just doing a simple little sort of zero D calculation. And then this is an experimentalist view of the world. But the idea is if you can think of the cluster as a uniform ion sphere with electrons driven by the field, you can account for all the different things that are going on in that sucker, heating, ionization. Here, some electrons will escape. It'll expand by these, you know, hydro and Coulomb expansion forces. Essentially, what you convince yourself is that what'll happen in the cluster, here's the electron density as a function of time. With the laser pulse, this is for a longish laser pulse in an argon cluster. There's initial fast ionization. We're going to come back to that actually towards the end. But for the time being, okay, this thing comes up fast. Okay. Then the cluster starts to get heated and expands. And sometime later, the density will drop and come into resonance with the laser pulse, right? And in this calculation, we see a pretty fast spike in the electron temperature. This is really not going to be physical, this very rapid spike. But it kind of gives you a sense of time scale. Of course, on this fast rise as well, this also goes through a 3 N crit resonance. As an ionization, you can see that fast spike there as well. When I was looking at this years ago, I sort of just ignored this and said, okay, it's not really going to happen. But actually, I think we have some evidence now that we actually do pass very quickly through this resonance on the rising edge. We see some of that. So when I end of my talk, I'll show you that. So anyway, this nanoplasma resonance, we see this in pump probe experiments. Okay, so this is a real thing. Of course, it's been known in metallic clusters for a very long time. So here are pump probe data from a while back, a few years ago, where we started with xenon clusters, hit them with about 10 to the 16 watts per square centimeter, about 30 femtosecond pulse, waited some time, and then looked at the absorption of the second pulse. And of course, it comes into resonance, it will absorb that second pulse. And sure enough, as we wait some time, and as we increase the cluster size, the time we wait has to become longer, okay, and your time study is long, it's picoseconds, sure enough, the absorption goes through this quite broad resonance. So this This whole nanoplasma picture seems to hold up pretty well, and other people have done experiments like this. I mean, this manifests itself in a variety of ways. That's an absorption. Of course, we also see it in the energy of the fragments that get ejected. I mean, we do experiments. This is now an experiment in Texas where we take a cluster beam and shoot it with our short pulse laser. The particles explode. You guys, everybody knows these kinds of experiments. And we look at the ion signal, and sure enough, same thing happens. Some delay. This is now two pulses that are the same intensity. One passes through the other. At some delay, we actually see an enhancement of the ion energies. So this almost certainly is coupling into that plasma resonance as the cluster has now expanded. Okay. So that's all seems. So that picture seems to work. Okay. Well, what really happens in the middle between this hydro expansion and the Coulomb explosion? That's probably the more relevant case, both for the laser experiments as well as for the short wavelength interactions. Like I said, you know, the initial photoionized electrons will be energetic, they'll leave. So what happens in the middle? And Thomas just mentioned this briefly, sort of gloss over, but I wanted to reinforce the point he made. You can model this as an ion sphere, a uniform ion sphere, and consider what happens to the electrons. Well, some electrons will get pulled off by the field. Okay, certainly in a strong IR pulse, the electrons will get pulled up along the laser polarization. But some of the electrons will be contained, and you can convince yourself, again with a little freshman physics, that the solution of Maxwell's equation in this case is to actually have the electrons shrink to a density so that there's a region in here that's quasi-neutral, and then this smaller electron cloud will shift if an external electric field is applied. Okay, so now if we're in a regime where the electrons move around quickly compared to whatever we're doing, okay, if I have an infrared pulse, my light's oscillating at 2.5 femtoseconds, okay, at solid densities, as I said, the electrons will respond on a 100 nanosecond time scale. So what probably happens in that case is, as we pull off electrons, the remaining electron cloud will sort of instantaneously, you know, contract, okay, and it'll get pulled back and forth by the laser and pull off electrons as the experiment continues. Okay, well, it just says the same thing. And so we see that in PIC simulations. Okay, you do simulations, and sure enough, that's what you see. Here's a simulation of some. These are hydrogen, so just for the sake of illustration, this is a 2D PIC simulation. Really, these are actually rods, but you get the idea. The red are the electrons, the blue ones are the ions, and as the laser field ramps up, you can see this electron core, which has a high plasma frequency, so that, you know, it instantaneously responds as I pull off electrons by the field, okay, the remaining core sort of contracts and fits that until eventually the laser field keeps oscillating and pulls off all the electrons. And you can see in the meantime, the ions have expanded. So this is going to have some implications for how these things explode, okay? And we're actually trying to see this, right? I mean, you might imagine getting into a regime where you've got an inner electron core, which is expanding hydrodynamically, and an outer shell, which is going to expand by Coulomb explosion. Okay, so now what the implications are for imaging this with X-rays, I don't know yet, but we should think about it. Okay, what am I going to say next here? So is there any experimental evidence that this does happen? I have PIC simulation evidence. Well, one bit of evidence might be to look at the expansion. So in my simple Coulomb or hydrodynamic expansion model, these are going to say the cluster explodes isotropically, right? I'm just creating this sphere, it should explode isotropically. But in this model, of course, you see the moving this inner electron cloud inside the ions breaks that spherical symmetry. And so you might imagine as you're pulling off electrons, now that the laser polarization is up and down, as you're pulling off electrons, there'll be a preferential acceleration of the ions along the laser polarization. Okay, and that's the idea. And then, of course, you also have some time average field inside here because of this moving cloud of electrons. One of the predictions of this model is that there'll be a slight anisotropy in the explosion. Here's essentially the electron. Well, this is electron momentum. Oh, excuse me. Here's the ion momentum as a function of angle. This is perpendicular to the laser field. Here's parallel, and you can see there's an enhancement in the ion momentum in this PIC simulation along the laser polarization. And sure enough, we see that in experiments. Here are some argon ion spectra Here's the ion energy. Here's the number of ions detected. As a function of polarization, here's parallel to the laser polarization. Here's perpendicular. It's a small effect, but it's there. Okay, here you can see the average ion energy. Here we're at intensity. We chose this intensity so that we knew in these big argon clusters, we wouldn't completely strip them, so we wouldn't get a Coulomb explosion regime. But we knew the intensity should be high enough that we would strip some of the electrons and we'd get in this intermediate regime. Okay, so that was the point of choosing this intensity. And sure enough, you see this very slight arcing of the average ion energy. Again, it's a little bit hotter along the laser polarization. So that seems to be consistent with this model as well. We see this in hydrogen as well. Hydrogen clusters, turn the intensity down now to match the binding energy to hydrogen. Other thing I also point out, so here again is that same sort of plot. Here's along the laser polarization, here's perpendicular. It's a little bit lower energy. The longer pulses actually give higher ion energies, it turns out, in these explosions. What we think is happening, remember I told you about this stochastic heating, okay? The longer pulses, even though the intensity is a little bit lower, there's more time for this stochastic heating to develop, heat up more electrons, pull more of them off, and we end up with higher energy ions. That probably means since this is the average energy, what probably means is we're just shrinking that inner electron core, and so we've got more ions in an outer shell, which are Coulomb exploding, okay? We're still looking at this, but that's probably what happens. Okay, so what probably happens in the short wavelength limit is some of the electrons will get pulled off, but of course the quantum motive force is quite small with the short wavelength light, so that inner core is probably just oscillating in the middle of that ion sphere shell, anyway, you get the idea, and that should explode. While the inner part will explode more slowly in hydrodynamically. So that's something we need to look for. Okay, so the question is, what happens to short wavelength? Okay, the first real bit of hard data on this came out of a really neat experiment from Daisy using the VUBFEL. I have to say, my German colleagues, I'm just envious as heck that you guys have got this machine up and running. So we're anxiously awaiting our boy Slack to get LCOS going so we can get in the game. But anyway, so they did this nice experiment. They irradiated xenon clusters at around 100 nanometers at sort of modest intensity. Essentially what they found is they cranked up the intensity, they found much higher charge states of xenon than they would have expected just from a single photon ionization. Okay. This is published in the paper in Nature a few years ago. Understanding this, I think, is in pretty good shape. I will have to say the wheels of theory have been rotating in response to these data. So, that's a very nice calculation. Anyway, I think this is pretty well understood. What's going on here is nanoplasma is forming, and it's getting heated up, and it's collisionally ionizing to higher charge states. Okay, so here they show this by changing now not the intensity, but by changing the cluster size, and as they went up to quite large xenon clusters here, they saw these highly charged xenon ions coming in. And this is something, so I dug up in the archives and found some old data we took way back in Imperial College back in the day with modest intensity infrared lasers, and in a xenon, sure enough, we saw quite high charge states, up to xenon 40 plus, even at 10 to the 60. And we just attributed this to this nanoplasma formation and collisional ionization. Okay, so this all seems to be fitting together, and I think we have a pretty good understanding of what's going on in infrared pulses. Do we understand what goes on a short wavelength? To some extent, but I think there's still more we need to look at. So this is sort of the thumbnail summary of what I think the qualitative differences are and what we might think about looking for in future experiments. How much time do I have? 11 minutes. Okay, so these are all the things I've said. In the infrared pulses, there's initial tunnel ionization. Of course, it's going to be by photoionization in the short wavelength. Quantum motive potential is large, almost certainly larger than surface potential in all these experiments. It's exactly the opposite for short wavelength. I mean, here for me, short wavelength is 100 nanometers or shorter. Okay, doesn't matter. By that time, at any reasonable intensity, the quantum motive energy is so small it's zero for all practical purposes. Okay, so that of course leads this difference between how the electrons are stripped. Okay, in the case of the laser, in the case of the infrared laser, the laser field is strong enough to pull the electrons out. What probably has to happen in the VUV or the XUV interaction is after the initial photoionized electrons leave, there will be some heating and some of them will boil off, so to speak. But that will happen on a quite different time scale than this. Okay, So now, what effect will that have on the reassembly of the ions and the expansion? Okay, so this is something I think we need to suss out. It will certainly be relevant to how long is that biomolecule hanging around with its ions in equilibrium position. Is it around long enough for us to image it? As I said, hydrodominance in this case, the infrared Coulomb explosion. Of course, there's quite a dramatic difference in the position of dipole resonance. And as I said, you know, this stochastic heating goes on with the infrared. It probably doesn't go on in the XUV. Now, I actually hoped at this meeting to have some data. What we're trying to do this is to say, well, you know, we don't have an XFEL, but we can generate short wavelength pulses, at least some modest energy, just by doing high harmonics. And so I think these experiments will probably be relevant just because we can get to reasonable intensities without the getting to these high quantum motive energies. So we can sort of mock up that situation, at least, you know, partially. What we're doing is we're taking our 600-700 millijoule Thai sapphire laser and focusing it at a gas jet and producing harmonics and refocusing them down. We've been looking at argon cluster explosions. I wish I had data shape. It's not quite ready for prime time. But anyway, the idea here is to try to get microjoules per pulse, and we think we can get up to about 10 to the 14 watts per square centimeter in the XUV. So we're also looking at some metallic clusters with this as well, but I'm not going to take time to tell you about that. So that's a kind of conjecture on short wavelength interactions with clusters. So now I'm going to continue my short wavelength thing by talking about, in the spirit of stretching the definition of various terms, I'm going to talk about third harmonic generation from clusters and call that short wavelength. So what are the other implications of this nanoplasma resonance, right? Okay. Not only is there resonance in the adsorption, as we've seen in those probe experiments, but there will be a resonance in any nonlinear function. So the Chi3, for example, you might expect to go through a resonant enhancement. And Boris Breisman and folks at Texas have looked at this, and sure enough, they see that. So here's a PIC simulation in a smallish cluster. I can't remember what the Z was, but here's the electric field ramping up. This cluster is starting to expand because it's not very large, and essentially what happens when they calculate the electron, the acceleration of the center of the electron charge distribution, it comes to a point where there's quite a dramatic enhancement in the third harmonic component of that oscillation. And that's not surprising. Essentially what's happening in the PIC simulation is the cluster's expanding and it's reaching the resonance condition for the third harmonic, and as you can see, the acceleration goes crazy, and then when you take the Fourier transform of this window, and sure enough, this third harmonic component comes up. So can we see that in experiments? So we've done this simple experiment, pump probe. Everybody in here knows the drill here. In this case, we're pumping with, this is done on Mike Donner's laser, by the way, who's a 100 femtosecond type sapphire laser. They pumped with a 400 nanometer pulse. It's 100 femtoseconds because it's going through a bunch of optics, okay? And then they probed with an 800 nanometer pulse and looked at the third harmonic generation as a function of delay in these exploding argon clusters, okay? And this ratio actually turns out to be important of how many clusters to monomers there are. The way they differentiated the third harmonic from any like four-wave mixing other processes is by momentum conservation. So they just came in at slight angles and looked at the correct angle for the third harmonic. So we know that we're looking at third harmonic and not anything else. So here are these data. This is delay. Each of these curves represents a different probe intensity. So we're cranking up the juice of probe light intensity as we go along these different curves. Okay, so the ones I want you to look at here, at least at first, here's delay, and sure enough, after the main pulse has come along and started the production of nanoplasma and started the clock ticking, lo and behold, there is indeed an enhancement in the third harmonic, okay? And you can see the time scale here is of the order of 300 or 400 femtoseconds. Okay? And this fits, you know, an IQ block. Third harmonic generation, quite convinced it's third harmonic generation from this oscillating electron core within this ion core. And, so there's enhancement in the Chi3, but there's also phase matching issues here as well. But I want to come back to that. Also notice a low intensity, there's a little bit of a blip, which happens a lot faster early in time. When we did this experiment initially, we sort of kind of ignored that and said, this is what we're looking for. This is great. And it is, okay. And in fact, one of the other nice things, finding it perfect. Okay. One of the other nice things here is, you know, as people who do nonlinear surface spectroscopy know, nonlinear optics is very sensitive to anisotropies. Okay. much better than linear techniques. So sure enough, we actually can see in the early times of the explosion of this cluster, we can see it becoming deformed and egg-shaped. Okay? So here are the third harmonic enhancements when the probe pulse is parallel to the pump polarization, and here it is when it's perpendicular. And so what's happening in the early time, in the early stage of this, starting to expand preferentially along the laser polarization, as we talked about because of this inner core model, all right? And when we're driving electrons across the egg, okay, the non-linearity is higher, and we get a larger enhancement in the third harmonic. Of course, we wouldn't expect this in the absorption, and sure enough, we don't. When you compare the two polarizations in the absorption, they look just the same. Okay, so here again, here's the time scale for the absorption. Remember, that'll occur when electron density is 3 times the critical density for the infrared. And just a little bit earlier, this is about 500-600 femtoseconds, a little bit earlier, about 300 femtoseconds, we hit that resonance condition for the third harmonic. Okay, so that all looks good. Okay, so all that does is prove that we our nanoplasma model, which we already knew worked, but this is the last thing I want to talk about, which I think is kind of cool. Just to bring this home, here's a calculation using that 0D model of the Chi3. And here's that plasma resonance, okay, so here the Chi3 jumps up because of the going through the 3N crit resonance, okay. Also turns out we get a little bit of help from phase matching, okay, and this is an effect that John Tisch in Imperial College predicted a few years back. He pointed out that if you have clusters, little cluster nanoplasmas in the medium, that you might set up conditions where phase matching would be a lot favorable, and so we don't quite get perfect phase matching in our experiment, but you get a little bit of help here as we go through that plasma resonance, and those two effects conspire to help out in enhancing the yield. So it turns out where we're going now is if we can tune the ratio of the number of clusters to the background gas density, we actually think we can get much better phase matching, okay? And this in principle should work at much shorter wavelengths as well, okay? So that's where we're going with this. And that just is because the refractive index, of course, has got a component from the plasma, but also there's a component from the polarizability of each of the clusters, okay? So like I said, John Tisch wrote this up some time ago and it explains this how all this works. Okay, so the takeaway point here is, getting back to my first slide, is there anything happening on an attosecond timescale with these classical charged fluids, which is interesting? Well, I don't know if this is interesting, it's interesting to me at least. So here's a calculation, again with that hokey little 1D plasma model, nanoplasma model. Here's the absorptive part of the cluster polarizability. Forget the dashed line, but okay. So remember, so here late in time, of course, the cluster's expanded and started to spread out and reaches that cluster resonance. But as the ionization is ramping up in time very quickly, that sucker goes through the resonance, and this thing pops up a little bit. And in our calculations, this thing is a couple pixels wide, right? We can't see how short this is. But there's every reason to believe that this could be pretty fast. So we actually see that in the third harmonic. Okay, remember I showed you late in time after the main pulse, we saw that sort of broadish third harmonic enhancement. Well, early in time, we actually see quite a sharp enhancement of the third harmonic. It's not as bright, okay, as this, this is actually the lower intensity data, so the absorption was kind of taking out the late time resonance. We didn't have enough intensity burn through. But we actually see a spike, which is basically as long as the duration of the laser pulse. Okay, so it looks like even that hokey little model, which I actually discounted years ago as not really being very accurate, even a hokey model seems to suggest what we see, which is some enhancement in the harmonics, and that would also mean that there will be a very fast enhancement in the absorption. But of course, it's happening much faster than the laser pulse duration, so we don't actually see it in the absorption, okay? But there's going to be presumably a fast enhancement in the absorption as well as the third harmonic, which we see. So my last hokey idea is to say, well, what implication might that have on a short wavelength pulse? My conjecture is, I'm hoping you guys will tell me that's a stupid idea later this week, but I'll throw it out there. Here again is my calculation of the electron density as a function of time. And there's this fast ramp, which presumably gives rise to that fast spike we see before the peak of the main pulse in the third harmonic. And if I just calculate, based on this, how quickly the electron density is ramping up, okay, it's about 10 to the 22 per femtosecond, okay, And of course, I know what the resonance frequency is in terms of electron density. If I have a 10 eV pulse going through there with some sort of reasonable bandwidth, this will pass through the resonance of that bandwidth on the order of a few hundred attoseconds. Okay? And this is a, you know, on this time scale, the collision frequency is much longer. Okay? So this thing oscillates just fine on the scale of femtoseconds. Okay? The collision frequency is on the order of a few femtoseconds or tens of femtoseconds. So I don't know if this will happen, but you know, the question is, if I came in with a gating pulse, which kicks this process off co-propagating with some 10 eV pulse, might I be able to eat out some sort of very fast, as I've shown you, we can turn the absorption up high enough that we can get essentially 100% absorption at the resonance. Could I possibly eat out some sort of dark pulse, which could be very fast? Now, I don't know what signature this would have, which don't really have any use, but it's sort of interesting because this could potentially be very fast. Well, there are a bunch of things which could smear this out. So, you know, there's, you know, these pulses won't have the same group velocity, and I don't think that's too bad. There's certainly going to be jitter in the initiation of the ionization. There's lots of other reasons why this may smear this out to something that's just much broader. But it's, I don't know, I think it's fun to think about. So anyway, I have to stop talking, and so I will. And I'll take questions. Wheel. Trust me, I'll stop calling you Wheel after today, I promise.
Yeah, so this your initial basically rise and going through the resonance, we also see we kind of also ignored that so far.
In
so it's very
in the particle simulations?
In our just MD simulations.
Right.
But including of course initial ionization by quantum rates, and I don't know how you do that, like the first ionization step in the model.
I use tunneling. In this case, it's using
tunneling
quantum rates, right?
Exactly. Okay, so isn't that maybe also due to tunneling? Because we saw basically the degree of ionization is only 1.5 in this first sharp peak. And so we weren't sure how this comes about. But I guess it doesn't matter in the end. I mean, you get the sharp change of...
There's the wavelength, right? I mean, I actually find just in my simple calculation that there's also collision ionization, which is kicking in as well. So it's kind of, that rise is kind of a combination of tunneling and avalanche afterwards, right? Is that consistent?
Yeah.
But, okay, well, anyway, maybe we can sort this out later next week,
Todd, it seems to me that if you can control this cluster ionizing gate pulse, so you can control this rise time in the ADK regime, is it then true that, say, at the 10 eV level, you have the potential for arbitrary shaping of a 10 eV pulse?
Well, I mean, the reason I've got this fast gate is because I pass through the resonance subfield.
Yes, yeah, so, but you can control that rate to some extent. In other words, you can control, I think, where this dark pulse, I won't call it a pulse, where this notch might be.
Yeah, you know,
maybe if you've done experiments at the 6th or 7th harmonic.
We just started thinking about this in the last week or two, right? I mean, we finally looked very hard. I mean, we saw this spike in the 3rd harmonic. Let me just ignore it, right? Because it's not where we're supposed to be, right? We're supposed to see this late time, but then spike. And so just recently we just started thinking about this, right? So I think the answer to your question is perhaps, but it's not obvious to me how to control
it. So if the 3rd harmonic is increases with a similar speed, shouldn't you see actually a significant broadening of the spectrum in the 3rd harmonic?
That's a good question, actually. I'll have to think about that. I don't know. If it is really that fast, okay, and if it really is sub-femtosecond, the answer is probably yes. Okay, that's a good question. I mean, basically, the width that we see in temporally is just the width of the probe, you know, the size of the probe pulse, right? Obviously, a different thing than width, but yeah, so spectrally, that's a good question.
Todd, would you mind pulling up the picture of the comparison of the VUV and the IR clusters, that table you had? IR pyramid.
Yeah, you guys found a special idea. Yeah, there we go. Get rid of that. Okay, does that work?
Okay, yeah, I wasn't sure how to interpret this no hot electron generation expected for the intense XUV irradiation, because our calculations at least show a lot of inverse bremsstrahlung that gets to several hundred EV electrons. Are you calling that not hot?
Those are warm to me. Hot are, you know, if at 10 to the 18, I've got to automotive energies in the infrared of 10 to 100 kilovolts, right? And so those will produce multi-kilovolt electrons. So that's hot to me, right? I mean, because those, you know, 10 or 100 kilovolt electrons, they'll undergo two passes and they leave, right? Mm-hmm. The 100 EV electrons, you know, can be confined by a large cluster. So yeah, that's.
So the different theoretical treatments of the clusters, the point where they really differ from each other dynamically is the charge state of the cluster as a function of time. Would your idea for possibly having a dark pulse taken out of, you know, say a 10 EV wide pulse, would that be able to distinguish between the different charge states particularly well?
Possibly. You know, if you were able to detect that notch, and then you were able to vary the photon energy of that 10 EV, I call it 10 EV pulse, and I think that you would, right? Because you can tune that through what the ionization is reached on that rising edge, right? So maybe so. Yeah.
On your slide that you use high harmonic generation to blow up the clusters, I just wonder, in your case, it seems you want to block the center part of your laser beam,
yeah.
And still want to produce 1 microjoule harmonics. Do you think it's realistic?
Yeah, we don't block very much of it. I mean, we just enough so that we don't torch the XUV in there. So it really wasn't drawn to scale. It only blocks like 10% away from
because the Japanese Midori Kawa School, they produce like 1 microjoule of harmonics, but they use beam splitter to split the harmonics from the laser.
Right.
That seems to be a little bit more favorable, in my opinion.
Yeah, maybe, but using the donut beam, actually, the focus in the far field, if you put the donut, you know, mode in or out, you can't tell the difference.
Sure.
I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference. We're not blocking the generator. We got lots of laser energy work, so, that's...
Okay.
It's just a question of how much you cut. I agree, right? We try to, like I said, we're only talking about difference. We cut a small hole in the middle, but you're right. And it's, yeah, we go to as long as we can focus as you can. I mean, our focal length is determined by the size of the room, basically. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you got to go long. Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, we're at something like F30. We're actually thinking about knocking a hole in the wall so we can go twice as far, actually. Right. How much energy were you using in your how much laser energy?
50
EV. Yeah, okay, so yeah, we're up, you know, almost 3.1 joule, right?
Okay, let's thank Todd again.